Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Now, detective fiction is a hugely popular and enduring genre ever since its golden age in the years after World War I. But some would ask, why should anyone, not least a Christian, be spending their time reading about death, murder and intrigue? Well, my next guest has been looking at this question and the origins of detective fiction, and she's here this morning to tell us more. Writer and blogger Rachel Sherlock, you are welcome. Very welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
First of all, Rachel, and not just because of your name, but did the popularity of detective fiction all start with Sherlock Holmes?
Pretty much. He's not quite the first literary detective, but it's kind of surprising how few there are actually before him, given that he's such a big name. But there are a couple. There's Poe, Bleak House. There's a couple.
Sure,
but
yeah. It's interesting too, isn't it, you know, that he was so well written that people thought he was real.
Yeah, no, he was very real in everyone's mind.
Yeah, I mean, people used to send letters to 222B.
Yeah.
You know.
I think he's has the most adaptations, like film adaptations. There's no character
sure.
that's had so many
really?
Variations as
wow.
Sherlock Holmes. Yeah,
yeah, that's amazing. I said 222B because I'm thinking of another detective story. The three investigators is 221B, actually,
yes.
isn't it, Jess? Mixing up again. Big fan of detective fiction since my childhood, as you can gather, if I was reading the three investigators. So Arthur Conan Doyle, obviously yes. the creator of Sherlock Holmes, he wasn't a practicing Christian, but do you think some aspects of his writing are based on a Christian worldview? Is that right?
Yes. So he was raised Catholic, and he was raised with a lot of different influences, but Catholicism was a very strong one, particularly through his mother and through his education. He had a Jesuit education, and he did lose his faith, but in a way that it was still a very important part of his life. He was very devastated to feel like he had lost his faith.
Mm.
And so religion always played a big part in his life. He really went into spiritualism, if anyone knows
yes.
the later
yeah.
Later years of Arthur Conan Doyle. He did a lot with
yeah.
Fairy hoax and things like
yeah,
that.
Not the healthiest of stuff to be getting into, for
not
sure.
Really, no.
But things like awareness of evil and that kind of stuff would have been very, very big with him in that
yeah,
case.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's elements even in, if you look at his Jesuit education, there's that real emphasis on striving for excellence. And I think mm-hmm. you can really see that with Sherlock Holmes. And even that element of kind of discernment, that mm-hmm. like to see clearly and to be very aware and to, as you said, recognize evil and do battle with it. I think
yeah.
that, I really think that has an influence on Sherlock Holmes as a character.
Do you have any feelings on why Sherlock Holmes was such a popular character, so successful?
Gosh, I mean, I think he's just, I think a lot of it actually has to do with Watson. It's that feeling of like being in Watson's shoes and looking at this very inspiring person and have that person reciprocate admiration.
Yeah.
That like the two of them are in it together. And when
sure.
you're reading it, you feel like you're in that adventure with
yeah.
them.
I think it's a very, very, that's a very good point, is that we are Watson.
Yes.
And we kind of travel with him. I was thinking too how interesting it was that Arthur Conan Doyle actually did know a medic who was very like Sherlock Holmes, so he was Watson, so
yeah.
he felt like Watson in that guise, and he really wrote Sherlock Holmes really in terms of, you know, the kind of the personality of this particular doctor. It was extraordinary. After Sherlock Holmes, you think everyone started to imitate Arthur Conan Doyle and when writing detective fiction, and this irritated a certain critic, is that right?
Yes, well, I don't think there's endless,
you know it.
an endless pile of Sherlock Holmes pastiches that you can go through, and every newspaper had to have their own Sherlock Holmes at that point. And this was much to the irritation of G.K. Chesterton, who was an enormous fan of detective fiction. He used to just stuff the stories into his pockets before going on the train by the hundreds.
Yeah.
Like he would just go through them. But he used to get really annoyed at all of these.
Yeah.
He loved Sherlock Holmes, but all of these kind of copycats, and they all followed the same formula, which was to be sort of this like otherworldly, mechanical, materialistic
yeah.
Thing. But because they weren't Sherlock Holmes, they had to get more and more ludicrous. And he said that he was always very disappointed that in these kinds of stories, the last page was always the worst page. When it should be the best.
Best. Very good, actually.
Yeah.
And of course, G.K. Chesterton was well capable of writing some detective fiction himself.
Yes, well then I think in some ways he kind of turned to it to make his own stamp on it.
Yeah.
He wrote a very famous series called with a character called Father Brown, who obviously in kind of complete contrast to Sherlock Holmes is a priest detective as opposed to a professional detective. And I love those stories. I think they're great. They really focus on knowing a person rather than knowing the clues. Like he always says that, he said that the big problem with those kinds of stories was that they tried to see a person from the outside as if it was an insect that you didn't understand and you were trying to gather clues from. But really, the best way to solve a mystery is to know the person as a complete person.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a kind of a warmth in the Father Brown stories that you don't get in Sherlock Holmes. There's a kind of a coldness in the Sherlock Holmes stories because it's about fact, you know. Whereas you get the feeling from the Father Brown stories, you write down to the very, like, there's nothing that gives Father Brown more joy than seeing somebody repent of their sin.
Well, I think that's it. That's the whole point, is that the reason he solves mysteries is not for the chase, and it's not for justice or the law or anything like that. He does it because he wants to find people and help them repent.
Yeah.
He's doing it. His detection work is almost like a part of his priestly duties.
And if we may race forward for a moment, and I do want to pick it up back there again, but you know, this recent number of series that have been done, I think, by the BBC, of Father Brown, they've attempted to keep that particular element in it. Now, I think some of it's very pastiche myself, and I sometimes find it a little irritating, but they do try to keep that bit alive, don't they?
I quite enjoy the series. I really think Mark Williams, who plays Father Brown, he's superb. I can watch him do Father Brown all day.
But it's
impressive that they kind of keep it to the fore. I think I don't want to skip ahead, but I've also discussed with my friends about how I think it's the ITV who did the Poirot series.
Yes, absolutely.
But they made a deliberate choice to even make his Catholicism even more present than it necessarily is in the book. So it's interesting that modern filmmakers and TV producers are choosing to keep these religious elements in their detective stories.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, fascinating. We'll come back to that. So the Father Brown, will you tell us about the Chesterton's early book? This was your favourite, I believe.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So this is The Club of Queer Trades, I believe.
Yes.
So tell me all about this, because this is a book I do not know at all. Is it a Father Brown book?
It's not a Father Brown book.
Okay.
It predates Father Brown.
Okay.
It's not a very well known book. It's got a title that most people would be a bit confused with these days. But
of course, it had a different meaning, of course, at the time, yeah.
But it's honestly one of the funniest and most clever books that I read. It's a series of short stories, but it has two characters that appear in all of them, two brothers. And essentially in every instance, the two brothers happen upon a circumstance which looks very suspect, and one brother, who's a big Sherlock Holmes fan, thinks it's got to be a crime, something nefarious is up, we have to get to the bottom of this mystery.
Yeah.
And in every case, the brother kind of shows, actually, this isn't what it looks like, and maybe there isn't even a crime to investigate, and you're just seeing it through this particular light. And the kind of thread that runs through it is this Club of Queer Trades, which is that the idea behind it is to be in the Club of Queer Trades, you have to have invented a profession that nobody else in the world has ever done.
Okay.
So these characters that are all in this club keep cropping up, and it's very funny. I really enjoy it.
And that's still accessible, is it? That's still in print somewhere?
It is. I got it in the library, so if anyone wants to check out the library.
I'm going to definitely check that out. I'm a big fan of Chesterton. Yeah. And of course, Chesterton wrote magnificent books, in terms of, apologetics and other things. And he was a great essayist and all the rest. But so it was, it's interesting that he was capable of writing good fiction as well.
Yeah, well, I think he's very like who would have been a friend of his, Ronald Knox, Ronald Knox was a great theologian, and he wrote several very important books. He was a priest. He was a convert from Anglicanism and became a Catholic priest. And he wrote The Belief of Catholics, which is one of those kind of tomes of Catholic reference. And he also wrote, I believe he wrote a translation of the Bible. So he was a really like academic scholar, but he also wrote really great detective fiction.
Yeah.
Which I really enjoy.
And of course, you can't help but think of people like C.S. Lewis as well, who was able to
flip between the two.
Yeah, between the two. And now to the writer who brought us Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple. Are you a fan of Agatha Christie?
I am, yes. Yeah. I have to say, she's so prolific that I think I've only really scratched the surface.
Yeah, well, absolutely, of course.
But I do work, I get audiobooks, and they are fantastic on audiobooks, I have to say. I love getting Agatha Christie audiobooks.
Yeah. So Poirot, obviously a Catholic character, and as you say, they've pushed that in recent times. Agatha Christie herself, she was a believer?
She had quite an eclectic upbringing. She had a lot of different influences, some of which were actually Catholic.
And she was Anglican, right?
She was Anglican.
Yeah. Yeah.
She married a Catholic archaeologist later in life, which led her to be part of something which I think is quite interesting in terms of Agatha Christie lore, which is that when they were getting rid of the Latin Mass in the Catholic rite, that she wrote to the Pope. She, along with a bunch of other famous writers, I don't think almost any of whom were actually Catholic, but wrote this letter to say, you can't do this. This is part of our heritage and our cultural tradition, and it should be open to not just Catholics, but everyone in the world to experience this. Yeah. And apparently the Pope saw it and saw her name and just went, fine, and ticked it. And so it became known as the Agatha Christie Indult, that it bears her name. So she has this place in kind of ecclesial history.
Wow. That's something I never knew. Brilliant. So what do you think Agatha Christie brought to detective fiction? What was her unique thing?
In all of detective fiction? Gosh, I think she's just so clever. Mm. And to be so consistently clever over so many different books is so impressive. And, you know, she like, in some ways people kind of think of her being quite repetitive. You've got two main characters, and in some ways a lot of the stories are quite parochial, but I find a huge variation. Like, if you think of something like And Then There Were None, which is very dark and disturbing, versus, you know, some of the kind of lighter ones. But I think it's that, and also a real sense that she understood people and their motivations. And she was just a great writer. She has that real kind of charm in her writing that's very addictive.
She does. And like, I don't know whether she was the first to do this, but certainly, you know, and not necessarily in the Hercule Poirot, which was much more the kind of the search for the murderer, usually. Mm-hmm. But certainly in Marple, that brilliant idea of making everyone, you know, giving everyone a reason to be guilty, giving everyone a motive, which really just, you flood the market with guilty looking people, and that's a clever ploy.
Exactly. I think Chesterton has a great quote in it, which is that every sort of man has been a saint, and I suspect that every sort of man has been a murderer.
Yeah. There you go.
And you can
and again, if you're good on the psychological, you're able to make that plausible in a book.
Yeah, and I think that's so true. That the real issue is that anyone could have done it, because anyone might have the motivation to do it.
Yeah, and it's funny how, you know, you should think that, you know, in the same way as you know, Sherlock written end of the 19th century, Christie's books written in the 30s and the 40s should be really passé by now, but somehow they still have something, and I think it's the human condition. You know, what do you think of detective fiction today?
Well, it's an enormous market. I feel like in some ways I can definitely speak to some of it, but to talk about contemporary detective fiction is almost to just say, what about contemporary fiction? There's just so much of it. I think there are some really great examples at the moment. I think one of the nice things I think about detective fiction is that it actually broadens people's horizons. It's one of the few areas that people really seem to embrace translated fiction, and I think translated fiction is often really great and where really innovative things are happening. So I quite like that about it, that it sort of broadens people out. I really like, there's an author called Fred Varga, she's a French author, and she does great things. She actually interweaves some religious elements and some kind of folklore elements. She's really great. I think obviously you can kind of pick whatever you like. If you like it really dark, or if you like it quite quaint, there's one series by Colin Cottrell, the Dr. Siri Pabboon, which is set in 1970s Laos, and there's only one coroner left in the entire country, and he's 70 and he really doesn't want to be there. And those are surprisingly charming and upbeat and lovely. You can get a lot of different things happening, which I think is exciting. But I do also feel maybe sometimes that, like, what always happens, a bit like after Sherlock Holmes, when you have 1,000 Sherlock Holmes pastiches. There's also a lot of, obviously there's a lot of subpar stuff as well.
I've always felt too that why is it that many people like, and Christians enjoy reading it, there is that feeling of resolution of, you know, of people being brought to justice, usually in a detective. It's part of the form. It rarely happens in a detective novel that somebody doesn't get caught and punished at the end. So there is that feeling of justice happening and things finishing.
There is that theory. That's why that detective fiction really exploded after the World Wars that you have this what's called the golden age of detective fiction, because especially after World War One, people wanted to make sense of the world, and in some ways World War One was that war where that didn't get resolution if you're talking about detective fiction, but also like war novels, usually there's a big victory and people kind of felt that, but in some ways I don't think World War One really felt like that. So
yeah, no, indeed it didn't. And similarly too, I was thinking, you know, why is it that they put these horrific, you know, Law and Order and all this stuff really late at night? And I think it's because there's resolution and then you go to bed.
Yeah.
Like, why isn't everybody just watching comedy before bedtime? And I think it's because with the resolution it gives people a kind of weird kind of peace.
Yeah, that there's order being restored to the world.
Yeah.
Chesterton says that's the real romance of the detective fiction, is that it's that actually the agents of chaos are the ones that are the kind of boring normal things, and that actually the quest for order and reason is this kind of romantic quest of the knight errant, and that's why we like it so much.
Absolutely, I love that. Writer and blogger Rachel Sherlock, great to have you back in studio with us.
Thank you so much
for talking to us. Have you ever considered a volunteering abroad? Well, the upcoming Irish Aid Volunteering Fair gives you a unique opportunity to meet and chat face-to-face with the main organisations in Ireland that offer overseas volunteering placements. On the line now to tell us more, we have Ruth Powell from COLOV. You're very welcome to the show, Ruth.
Thank you, Roland.
And
good morning.
There she is. How are you? That was actually entirely our fault. There was a particular setting on the channel, and I haven't a clue what it was, but somebody
no
obviously banged
We're
into
on
it.
Now.
Yeah, so first of all, Ruth, tell us about COLOV's involvement with the Irish Aid Volunteering Fair.
Yeah, so my name is Ruth and I work for an organisation called COLOV, and we are the Irish Association of Volunteers and Development Workers, and we provide supports and services to people thinking about volunteering internationally. We give advice before they go, we can give assistance while they're away, and we can give debriefing when they come back. And we assist Irish Aid organising their annual Irish Aid Volunteering Fair, which takes place on Saturday. So we help them put it together, and hopefully it'll be a great event. Yeah.
Yeah. What type of overseas volunteering placements will be showcased at this fair?
Yeah, there's 30 organisations, what we call volunteer sending organisations, and the types of placements that they have on offer are varied and diverse. Some of them are very short term, so that would be 3 weeks or 4 weeks, and some of them are quite long term, so up to 2 years. And then there's a different amount of sort of thematic variety within them as well. So there might be health placements, education placements, construction, IT. More and more we're seeing a lot of IT placements. So a real variety. So that's why we have 30 organisations there, because they all have very different programmes and projects.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, in terms of what we used to refer to as the missions, you know, past, you know, there was always quite a lot of people who would be involved in, you know, not necessarily in faith endeavours, but would be involved in real practical stuff like engineers and various things will go out. So what volunteering placements are proving to be popular, do you think, this year?
I'm not quite sure which ones will prove to be popular on the day. Hopefully each organisation will have... What we try and encourage visitors to do is to go to each organisation and pick up all the leaflets and all the information and sign up to the newsletters and find out what type of placements they have on offer, and then take all the information home and have a think about it quite carefully afterwards. But typically, you know... The popularity depends on what placement the person is looking for.
I take your point, actually, Ruth, because in a very real sense, you're going to be, if you can kind of, it's almost you have to create almost in a relationship with what it is that you're thinking about doing.
Yeah.
And if you have two or three or four options that are kind of in the general area that you want to, and then you start getting things like newsletters, you can kind of connect in that with the various organisations that way, I guess.
Absolutely. And like what we'd really encourage people to do is, if you're thinking about volunteering next summer or next September or even January 2021, to start looking now, start trying to get the information together. And Saturday will be great, because very often people go onto the internet and they can be quite overwhelmed by the amount of information and what's this organization doing, and what do I have to do to sign up, whereas on Saturday you can actually talk to the organisations themselves. Most of them have at least one staff member there, but more importantly, most of them will have a returned volunteer and development worker with them as well. So a potential volunteer can get the truth from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, absolutely. You make a good point. You know, there's something about being at a fair like this, where you literally speak to a human being, and the human being is able to really cut through all the nonsense in a way the internet can't, you know.
Yeah.
And kind of go, no, that wouldn't suit you. This sounds more like your thing, and then you're
exactly
able to talk, you know.
Or you might just get a good feeling, you know.
Yeah.
You might go up to one stand and say, I'd really like to work with these people. They're doing something that I'm attracted to, and I find it interesting, and I want to find out more. So as much as the placement is important, and the geographical location and the amount of time and the sort of skills that you might or might not need, what's equally important is, do you think you can work for this organization? Do you think that you can follow their values and their ethos? Are you going to be happy wearing their t-shirt, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So Ruth, who would you encourage to attend the fair? Who is it really geared towards?
Yeah, so I think anyone who's even vaguely interested in international volunteering, be it in the next 6 to 12 months or sometime in the future, because they can browse the exhibition stalls, they can have a chat to people, they can pick up the information. But we'd also encourage returned volunteers to come along as well, because we've got 4 workshops through the day, and 2 of the workshops are specifically designed for returned volunteers who might still want to stay involved in the sector but are not quite sure how to do that, you know. And they might have returned back to Ireland a few months ago or a few years ago or even a few decades ago, but we would encourage returned volunteers to come along and see what's happening and see how they can stay involved as well.
And is there a particular age group that it's aimed at, or a particular in knowledge or education level or anything like that?
No, it really is a full spectrum. I mean, there's lots of placements for students and recent graduates, definitely. That's a particular cohort that some of the volunteer sending agencies are recruiting for. But then equally, we've got agencies that are looking for people who are quite close to retirement and have years of experience, so can arrive in country and just get on with the challenges and get into it because they have, you know, 2 or 3 decades worth of experience to fall back on. We're also looking for people that might want to learn skills during the placement, so might not necessarily have, let's say, an education background, but might be willing to go with a group and learn as they're volunteering. And then, of course, we've got the more typical type of placements, which would be for people involved in education and health. They are always very, very strong. Yeah,
absolutely. For someone who's considering volunteering overseas, and I imagine there's some people listening in now going, what are the important factors that you would try to get them to consider first?
Well, first of all, to really try and think about their own motivations. Why are they doing it? What are they thinking about? How realistic is going away? And what are their kind of, what are the things that they must have? So to try and think about the realities of the situation as well. Do they want to be in a big group of 20 other volunteers for a short period of time? Or do they want to, are they much more interested in a more integrated approach of being away for about 2 years, possibly in a rural area, trying to learn the language, trying to be much more involved in the community? What kind of experience are they thinking about, and what are their realistic expectations? And to put time into it, you know?
Sure.
So if you were thinking about changing career or moving house or moving country, you'd give it a considerable amount of time and thought and consideration. And we'd just like people to give it that sort of respect. Yeah,
yeah, I can imagine people making decisions on the spur of the moment. They can kind of regret them at the leisure later on, because you really could find yourself somewhere at the other end of the world going, why did I decide to come here, you know?
Well, exactly. And something that, for example, might suit you, Ronan, it might not suit me, you
exactly.
know? So you have to be realistic with your expectations and your motivations, and to just give it a bit of time to think about the right placement for you. And because on Saturday there are so many placements on offer, you can really have a look around, you know.
And if you can't travel, are there further options to make a difference?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. A couple of the organisations are specifically looking for volunteers who will volunteer in Ireland, but for their overseas development work. And they're always looking for people to help them with fundraising and campaigning and different events and activities. So absolutely, you don't have to travel. And we would seriously suggest that that's not the only way to assist in the fight against inequality. You know, there are many, many different ways to do it. And I think coming Saturday as well, you'd be able to find which organization, again, you might have a natural affinity for.
You know, I was thinking as well, even from a psychological point of view, I'm always telling people that giving stuff away, you know, just for its own sake is really, really healthily psychologically. I think Tony Robbins refers it to it as contribution. So volunteering is actually really, really good for us. Yeah. It makes us happy.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And I think if you're volunteering for something that you believe in and you're giving time and energy towards it, you get a lot of rewards for that. There's no doubt about it. And you also meet like-minded people and you get involved. And the more you get involved, the more you find out about international development and what that is. And it's sort of peculiar nuances and its difficulties as well. So definitely it's good to get involved, and it's good to find out how you can get involved and what sort of way you can and the different sort of things you can contribute.
Absolutely. So just for one last time there, Ruth, could you tell us when and where the Irish Aid Volunteering Fair is taking place?
Yes, so it's in the Hibernia Conference Centre in Dublin Castle on Saturday the 9th of November. It starts at 11 o'clock in the morning and it goes right through till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The exhibition space is open all day, that's 11 till 4, so you can pop in, drop in, give it an hour so you can talk to all of them. But then there are workshops through the day as well. There are four workshops, one from 12 to 1, 1 to 2, 2 to 3 and 3 to 4, so you can drop in to one or two of those workshops as well.
And is there any charge?
No, it's free of charge, and it's a beautiful venue. The Hibernia Conference Centre in Dublin Castle is gorgeous, and they're always very good to us there, and there'll be plenty of people and nice chats, and if the weather is like what it is today, you may as well be inside, right?
Absolutely. My goodness, what a day it is. Ruth Powell from Coloff, thank you so much for talking to us today.
You're very welcome,
God
Ronan. Thanks for having us on.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. And the websites are www.irishaid.ie or www.colov.org, and of course Colov, to all of you non-Irish speakers, is spelled COMHLAMH.org. Irish Aid Volunteering Fair 2019 will be held in Hibernia Conference Centre, which is in Dublin Castle, on Saturday the 9th, that's Saturday coming, 2019, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Now, Ron Huntley is from Nova Scotia in Canada and is the co-founder of Divine Renovation Ministry, an organization that provides coaching for pastors, priests, and ministry leaders to help them move their churches and parishes from a focus on maintenance to one of mission. Ron was in Abbeyleix, County Laois, at the Alpha Ireland Conference last month, and Spirit Radio's Steve Johnson caught up with him there. Here, Ron Huntley shares with Steve about his life and faith as he takes on the Life in Five Challenge.
My name's Ron Huntley, and I'm from Halifax, Nova Scotia, in Canada. I'm a father of two beautiful kids, and I love Jesus, my mom, and sports.
Is this your first time in Ireland, Ron?
Yeah, it is. I'm really excited to be here. My grandfather actually was a Catholic who immigrated to Canada from Northern Ireland. And so I'm really excited to get up to Belfast later on this week and just kind of stand on the property that he grew up in and just kind of get a sense of my Irish roots. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking up the Life in Five Challenge on Spirit Radio. And you've chosen five questions. And your first is a favorite Bible verse and why?
So my favorite Bible verse is from John chapter 10:10. I didn't know where that was when it struck me, but I was home one day. I don't know, just really out of the blue, that scripture came to my head, that Jesus saying that I came that you might have life and have it to the full. I've always liked having a good time. And my health was good. I finished university, had a good education, good friends, good job, but I knew there was something missing. And for some reason, God placed that scripture on my heart. And I realized that although I had a lot of great things in life, there was more to life than what I was experiencing. And even though I'd gone to church my whole life, I recognized that I've never really gone all in. And so I said to Jesus, I made him a deal. I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go all in the Roman Catholic Church for 1 year. And if you don't give me life and life to the full, I'm going to quit because I'm tired of being a hypocrite. And that verse changed my life because I'm still here.
Your next question, Ron, is a time you heard something clear from God.
Years ago, I was traveling out in the Rocky Mountains in Canada with a friend of mine, and we decided to climb up Rundle Mountain. We'd never done it before. We left too late in the day to make it to the summit, but we didn't know that. We brought no food and no water. We were in really good shape, and we were full of testosterone. And as we're going up the mountain, people are coming back down, and they asked us, where are you going? And we said, we're going to the summit. They said, you can't do that. There's not enough time. We said, oh, yes, we can. Just really naive young men. And we just ran up that mountain, and it took hours and hours and hours. And while we were almost to the top, little did I know I got altitude sickness, and I lost all my energy instantaneously. And I started to get really bad headaches and dizzy, and it took me a long time to climb that last 50 yards. And when I got to the top, I was dry heaving, and I didn't have a liquid in my body. And we're at the top of the mountain with nothing. I actually felt like I was going to die. I wanted to die. That's how sick I was. But I knew how afraid my friend was because he'd never seen me in that situation, because back then I was quite strong and exercised a lot and was very fit. And he'd never seen me like that. And I knew we had to go because we didn't have any time. And I was probably up there for a good 45 minutes getting sick and just laying flat out. And if my friend wasn't with me, I would have just stayed there. But for his sake, I kept trying to get up and I kept falling. And I could see the fear in his face. And I had fallen twice already. Only go like 5 or 10 feet, I'd fall again and start dry heaving again. And on the second time I fell, I knew I couldn't do it. And I said, Jesus, if you're real, you have got to get me down this hill. I'm going to get up one more time. And if I fall, that's where I'm going to stay. And it was like I heard the most powerful, strong male voice look right at me, and he said, get up. And I got up and I walked all the way down that mountain, and I never looked back. And I never told my friend that. I hope he's listening. But it was Jesus himself that carried me down the hill that day. And it was unmistakable because I had nothing left.
Wow. Yeah. Well, maybe your friend will hear this on the internet. He'll hear that. That is an amazing story, Ron. Well, if we haven't already heard one, your next question is, have you ever seen a miracle?
I was in my early 20s and again, went to church my whole life. Always found Jesus really exciting, the scriptures really exciting, and church really boring, if I was to be honest. And I really didn't understand the disconnect between the excitement of Jesus and the boredom of going to Mass. And part of it's probably my own inability to understand and to sit still very long. I was always an active person. I love to run and wrestle and fight and keep score. And so sitting for that period of time, I always found hard. And so church was, I always went, but it didn't always make sense to me. I was invited to go on a weekend retreat, and really I just went because of a girl, to be honest with you. And it was really neat, some great speakers. The music was really lively, which I wasn't used to. I was used to organs and really bad choirs. And the whole thing was quite fun. And there was a priest and a lay woman who were kind of the keynote speakers. And I remember after that Saturday afternoon, they said, after supper, tonight we're going to do healing. And I thought, do healing? Like, that's weird. Like, I read about it in scripture, but I've never experienced it or seen it. And so I remember coming back that evening very curious. And so they went about doing this healing ministry, just kind of praying and asking the Holy Spirit to come and expressing words of knowledge of healing for certain people. And I thought, this is really neat. I didn't know if anybody was being healed, but it was just neat to be there. Then at one point, the priest said, and if there's anybody else who would like to come forward for healing, just come on down to the stage on the side of the stage and we'll pray for you. And so this was happening and people were coming up being prayed for headaches and sore backs and things like that. And every time he prayed with them, he invited the people in the audience to just extend their hand in prayer. And all of a sudden, there was a boy on the left-hand side of me, I noticed starting to get up, and he had crutches. And he was only young, I'm guessing between 10 and 12, and he starts on his crutches making his way to the front. And I thought, I wonder what he's doing. I hope he's not going forward for prayer. because he actually has a real problem. Like, if you have a headache, I can't tell. If you have a bad back, I can't tell. But I can tell this boy has a problem because he's on crutches and he can't walk. And I'm thinking, there's no way the leaders of this conference are going to let him go forward, because that would be irresponsible, because we all know he's not going to get healed. And what's going to happen to his faith when he doesn't get healed? And nobody was telling him to sit down. So I started panicking inside. I started praying. Like, I thought, how irresponsible are these Christians? Like, they're going to destroy this young man's faith. And I was panicking. And the closer he got to the front of the line, the harder I prayed. And I'll never forget, the priest looked at the boy and he said, "Son, do you believe that God can heal you?" And he said, "Yes, I do." And I started to cry, because I thought, God, if you're real, you have to heal this boy. You have to heal this boy. And he asked us to extend our hands, and I extended my hands, and it felt like my hands were extending three rows. I was praying so hard, and I was bawling. And after he finished praying for the boy took his crutches, lifted them up over his head, jumped up out of the chair, and ran off the stage, ran all the way back to his seat and sat down, and I just wept, and I just heard Jesus say to me, "Oh, ye of little faith." And I just realized I've put God in a box my whole life, and I had served what I had concocted as a powerless God. He was impotent because of the ways that I experienced my faith, and the little bit that I would put into my faith. God was not the Lord of my life. I was the Lord of my life. And that day I said, "I don't want to be the Lord of my life anymore. You are real. You're way bigger than I thought you were. And I just want to be serve you and love you."
What a fantastic story, Ron. Thanks for sharing that memory with us. Your next question, Ron, is a testing time in your life.
The first time I experienced really the power of God's love in my life, I was 16. My mom made me go on a boys' retreat, which I did not want to go to. I had two hockey games and a football game that weekend, and I tried everything I could to get out of it, but she wouldn't let me. She forced me to go, but it changed my life. But I was 16, and I was still trying to fit in and understand what it meant to be a man. My parents were separated, and so I think I lacked, you know, a male role model in my life. My dad was still in my life, but probably not to the degree which would have been helpful. And so through university and stuff, I spent a lot of time trying to fit in and getting my ideas of what it meant to be a man from friends on sports teams and in locker rooms. And so chasing girls and drinking way too much became a real part of my life. And it was an empty part of my life. It was an empty time in my life. But I really didn't know what else to do. And I remember one day looking myself in the mirror. I had three jobs while I was going to university, and just so happened all three Christmas parties were three nights in a row, and all three of them had free beer. And I drank way too much all three nights. And I remember looking at myself in the mirror on that third night, and I didn't recognize myself. I thought, what are you doing and where are you going in life? Like, if you keep making the decisions you're making, you're not going to be the man you know that you're being called to be. And I scared myself sober, because I knew that God loved me, and I knew that God was calling me to love, but I was just a mixed up, confused time in my life. And I think there's a lot of men that also experience that type of searching and loneliness and confusion. And I was certainly one of those young men.
It occurs to me, Ron, that it was actually a good thing that you looked in the mirror and asked those questions, and maybe a lot of young people don't even take the time for that, because maybe even they have more things to distract them than you did back then. So you'd encourage people to look in the mirror?
Yeah, because I think we all know in our souls that we're called to greatness. Now, I heard somebody say one time, Jesus didn't come to take away our suffering. He came to make us great. And we have the capacity for greatness built right into us, because we're made in the image of God. And it's so cool. And there's so many lies that we believe, and there's so many distractions in life, but we know deep in our soul that we are made to be great, to love great, and to live our lives in love and service of others, because that's where happiness is. And so, yeah, if you take the time to be honest with yourself and just start talking to God, even if you've never prayed in your life, even if you don't know God is real, Just assume that you have a father who loves you, and just acknowledge the fact that you're really messing up, because we all mess up. Welcome to the human race. But just begin to have an honest conversation. Don't worry about what prayers you know or don't know. Just have a conversation. and be brutally honest with yourself and ask yourself deep in your soul, is there more to life than this? And then listen.
It also occurs to me sometimes, Ron, that we paint a bit of a sort of a soft picture of Jesus. And I always think that for people who are involved in sports, team sports, endurance sports, that there's so much to be admired in the person of Jesus in terms of endurance, you know, going through suffering for a greater goal. And as you say, we're not made for an easy life, we're made for greatness. Like, nobody who's involved in sport aspires to have an easy life. They aspire to achieve great things, having gone through a lot of suffering in the process. And so, yeah, that particularly moves men. And maybe we don't emphasize that side of Jesus's life and character enough.
You know, as a man, to protect and to provide is deep in my DNA. I remember the first time I had a child, like the fact that I wasn't where I wanted to be in my career yet, I got so motivated when I heard that my wife was pregnant, that there was nothing that was going to stop me from being the father my kids deserved and my wife deserved. And so, you know, I think as men, what are we fighting for and who are our enemies? Like, who's the enemy? And as I see the church, just the fabric of church just being destroyed and churches being just so mediocre, I think to myself, men, rise up and fight. Like, there's a fight to be had. And I don't know, I just like to fight. Like, when I played hockey, I fought all the time. And there's something in us as men that wants to fight. But let's fight for the best of things. Let's fight for what God is calling us to fight to. Jesus was no pansy. My uncle's a carpenter. I can't beat him in an arm wrestle, no matter how much I worked out. He was strong. Jesus was strong. Men are called to be strong, to provide and protect. And the church needs us to rise up, to man up, and to take our place in the church in a way that we work together to lay our lives out in love and service of others. And boy, that's going to be a great day. And I don't know anybody who fights better than Irish.
So your final question, Ron Huntley, what makes you happy?
It's funny because you talked about, you know, sports and sacrifice. Both of my kids, I played a lot of sports, although I wasn't good at any of them. Both of my children are very good at sports. And, you know, one of the things that I enjoy so much is watching my kids play sports. I would rather watch them than any professional sports because, you know, when I walk into a crowd or I go into a stadium and see my kids with all these beautiful people there, my eyes don't rest until they rest on my children. And there's nothing I delight in more than to see my kids having fun, enjoying, competing, growing, working in teams. And so watching that in sports to me is so much fun. But I often think to myself, do you know, and if you're a parent, you know this, that your eyes do not rest until they rest on your children. And for all those that are listening, I want you to know that God's eyes don't rest until they rest on you. He knows every hair in your head, every thought that you have before you think it. He knows when you sit and when you stand because he loves you. And it wasn't until I became a father that I realized, just got a slight glimpse of how much God loves me. And it's sometimes hard to let him love me because I know there's so many ways I don't deserve it. But I don't love my kids because they deserve it. I love my kids because they're my kids. And I think that's how God loves us too.
Yeah, that was Ron Huntley, co-founder of Divine Renovation Ministry and co-author of the book Unlocking Your Parish, talking earlier to our very own Steve Johnson. And we will be continuing the Life in Five series every Thursday shortly after. Now, our next guest has a dream to get to space, and while she hasn't got there yet, she's been involved with some fascinating space-related projects, including a simulated Mars mission. On the line to tell us more about her upcoming events, Baking in Space, as part of Cork Science Festival and Science Week Ireland, we have engineer and scientist Dr. Niamh Shaw. You're very welcome to the show, Niamh. How are you?
I'm great, Ronald. Thanks very much for calling me. I'm always happy to talk about space.
First of all, Niamh, where does your interest in space stem from? Was space something you were always interested in, even as a child?
Yeah, it was. It was a big part of kind of, you know, our family kind of dynamic. We were all mad science fiction fans, and we loved watching science programs together, and the moon landing has inspired a lot of us in the house. So yeah, it was always there. But I think when it came to me figuring out, you know, my career and making steps forward, it just, you know, it didn't even dawn on me that I could have a career in that field. And of course it's great nowadays because people can, and they probably could have in my day as well. I just wasn't aware of Ireland's already involvement in the European Space Agency.
Sure,
so
yeah.
It's a big part of why I do what I do, is to kind of highlight the opportunities that are available to Irish people in the space sector. You know, you don't have to be an astronaut to be part of space.
Yeah.
There are so many different careers available now, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I know what you mean, yeah. Because, you know, when something doesn't seem like it's accessible to you, you immediately discount it instead of realizing
you don't even think about it, you know? And if I had of, you know, having spoken to a lot of people who did succeed in becoming part of the space sector, who were from my generation, they either kind of went to the Kennedy Space Center, or they had a relative already working in the European Space Agency, or they wrote to an astronaut and the astronaut wrote back. So the notion of that, whether we like it or not, we kind of inspire the people around us is something that's really important. And I guess it's a big part of why I've gone so public in what I want to do, because I kind of hope that maybe there's somebody out there who kind of wants to do something that they think is impossible, and if they hear about me doing something as incredibly impossible as my goal to get to space as sort of a communicator and a performer, then maybe it might break down a few barriers
for
them.
Sure, so, absolutely. Yeah. So tell us about the simulated Mars mission you were involved with. Yeah. Talk us through this, and what was it like?
It was very difficult. It was completely outside my comfort zone, but thankfully I was among a crew of people who were experienced in being in the field like that. But essentially, it's a facility that's in the middle of the desert in Utah, in a landscape that looks very like Mars, which is why it's selected. And it's run by the Mars Society. And research takes place there, and you apply. It's quite a strict application process, quite a long and intensive application process. And I was asked to join them. I knew them because a lot of us had participated the previous summer in a 9-week graduate training program called the Space Studies Program. And they kick-started a bid to apply for a crew to go to the Mars Desert Research Station in Utah. And I kind of said, I'd love to go, but, you know, I don't have any experience in astrobiology or geology. I said, but, you know, my ability to document and to describe and be your kind of crew artist would be something I'd be interested in. And they did. They invited me along to do that. And so I found myself, you know, in January 2017 heading off with them. And even it was the weirdest thing, even though it was just a little over 2 weeks, it felt like months, because we were completely shut off from the real world. So money has no value, you know, there's no TV, there's very, very limited internet, really, just to communicate with mission control. We had to upload reports every day. And every time you go outside, you wear a sort of a spacesuit. It's not a real spacesuit, but it's sort of, it's representative of it.
It's as though you're on the surface of Mars in a space vehicle of some sort.
Yeah. And then the food as well is long-term stable food. It's all dried food.
Dried food. So no showers, none of that stuff?
No.
Wow.
And very limited water. And you would only flush the toilet for number twos, not number ones.
Yeah, that's gas.
You just very quickly to it.
And can I just ask you, because, I mean, I suppose enjoyable is the wrong word for the experience, but was it a learning experience? Was it something special?
Very much so. I mean, you know, I got incredibly close to my crew. We have a genuine love for each other, like we do anything for each other. So getting to hang out with them was brilliant, as tough as it was. But it was very rewarding. And when I came back to Ireland, it really has changed. It changed everything. It changed the way I lived. It changed my whole understanding of...
Really?
Yeah, of water usage and everything. Like,
yeah, of course.
I got rid of my car.
Wow.
I consciously buy clothes in consignment stores because I didn't need clothes when I was there, and it really made me understand, like, you know, the fast fashion and how, you know, environmentally it really isn't a good idea. It just made me more aware of how easy it is to live with very little if you have the right living circumstances.
That's a profound experience like that, and it's only 2 weeks out of your life, but it really changes the way you think.
Amazing. It makes me a big part of what it kind of changed and clarified for me a lot of the reasons of why I'm doing what I'm doing, because I could see a lot of the benefits of when you try to you know, your living circumstances change and you have to come up with a solution, you know, which is what a lot of people in the space sector do. They have extreme environments and they have to kind of design housing for that. They have to design, you know, living conditions, safe living conditions for people. And what made me see was that there's a lot of things that have been designed and engineered to overcome solutions of, you know, human missions to space to survive in these extreme environments that we can actually apply back to Earth.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's even amazing innovations that have taken place on board the International Space Station, you know, like better water purification systems, air purification systems, that are now kind of dripping down into technologies in third world countries and energy systems and things like that. So there's a lot we can learn from stepping off this planet in order to bring benefits back down to Earth.
You've also, I was going to say, you've also taken a zero gravity flight.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I've seen some of those movies where they did the zero gravity flight, and you know, in order to try in some ways make a, you know, a semblance of what it's like to be in space. When did you do that, and what was that like?
I did that in August 2017, and I was very lucky that I got that opportunity. I was speaking to a colleague who's also an artist, and he had made some incredible work with a group of Mexican artists that he's a part of. And I was like, and I called him, it was one of the things I wanted to do, and I asked him, like, how did it happen? And it's incredibly expensive. I was like, oh, that's never going to happen. And then out of the blue, he messaged me. One day there had been a cancellation of another kind of group, a charter, where they had, you know, they had organized another zero gravity flight for an outreach kind of project. And so I got my visa to go to Russia, and the next thing I found myself just outside Star City, working with the team who trained the cosmonauts at the Cosmonaut Training Center. And we were on the plane, the special flight that simulates this zero gravity sensation. So you get so what happens is it's a maneuver that's kind of like a really sharp angle triangle, like a triangle at 45 degrees up and then down. And it's on the turn of that triangle that you actually go into free fall. So you do that 10 times, so you have 10 episodes of that.
Gosh.
But the hard part is the free fall bit is the fun bit.
Is it?
But yeah, but it's also scary as well.
Absolutely. I say the hard part is keeping your lunch down.
That's weird. When you're on the way up and on the way down, that's what happens. In order to have that pocket of weightlessness or the sensation of weightlessness, you have to experience twice the force of gravity on your body, and that's extremely hard. It's awful. It feels like this dull pressure that's on your body from head to toe, and it's really not pleasant. And
that that's G-force, what as they call feel. It.
Yeah, G-force. And if you move a lot in that phase of the flight, that's when a lot of the vomiting kind of starts to kick in. But thankfully, I didn't vomit. I didn't know where my body was, so I held on to the bar. There's a kind of a bar that they tell you to hold on to for the very first one.
Yeah.
And I just ended up holding on to the bar for all of them, bar one, group one, because I couldn't figure out what was happening in my body. It's great fun, but you can't figure it out. And then you would go to move, and you give yourself too much of a push, so you go way too far and way too fast. So it's hard to know
very
how
disorientating.
Much you move your body. So,
yeah, absolutely.
I'd love to do it again, because the more you do it, the better you get at it.
Yeah, I am sure,
Listen, astronauts have to do about 100 maneuvers to get it.
Yeah, I could have well imagined before you get really, really good at it.
So
tell us about the upcoming event at Cork Science Festival.
Yeah.
We're calling it Baking in Space, which I love,
baking,
by the way.
I know. So it's great. So it's the notion about, you know, human exploration and the importance of food in all of that. So it's created with British Council and myself, and funded by Science Foundation Ireland and Yakult. And I work with Andrew Smith, a fantastic finalist from the Great British Bake Off series, who's also an aerospace engineer, and he and I have put together a show which is half kind of live food demonstrations that he does, which kind of demonstrates some of the materials that we need to survive in space. And then we have a panel of experts, and they're fascinating. We have Romain Charles from the Astronaut Center at ESA, who works directly with astronauts in planning their missions and also their diet for what they want to eat, special food items for when they are on their mission on the International Space Station. So he would work with the astronaut and a chef from their country to create special food items. And he'll be bringing samples of the types of food that astronauts eat in space and the way it's packaged. And he himself was part of a simulated Mars mission, except his was for 520 days.
Wow.
Way back in 2010.
Wow.
And then also to kind of highlight, the many Irish people that are working in the space sector, we have people from Blackrock Castle Observatory, who is also, that's the space center in the city, that have very strong connections with the European Space Agency and run lots of space-related activities for schools and the public at the castle. And then we also have Professor Alan Keddy from the Food Science and Technology Department at UCC, who is talking about, how do you process food for space and what kind of preservatives would you use and what kind of ingredients can you use and freeze-dried food and things like that.
Yeah.
And there'll be lots of demos, lots of tastings, there's lots of things to eat, there's lots of stickers, lots of giveaways. So,
brilliant.
We would prefer for the show to be free, but unfortunately, we had to charge €5 because we're touring it this year,
yeah.
And we just had to make to cover our costs. But
€5 is very reasonable.
I think we'll realize it's money well spent.
So
we're delighted to be bringing it to Cork this year as part of the Cork Science Fund.
So let's give the details, because I know it's in Cork, yeah. It's also in Dublin, it's also in Galway. So can we give those details now?
Yeah, so it's in Dublin next Monday. We've got two shows at 2:30 and 7:30 in Smock Alley. And then we all upship and go to Galway. And we're on in Galway on Tuesday, November the 12th in the Black Box Theatre at 7:30. And then we finish off, thankfully, in Cork. And we will be on Wednesday night in Kino at 7:30. And we'd love everybody to come along. It's a family event. It's not just for people interested. Science. It's for all the family, because we all eat and we all love to bake.
Absolutely. So Smock Alley, Dublin on the 11th, Black Box Theatre, Galway on the 12th, and Kino in Cork on the 13th. And is there any, do people need to, register somewhere?
You can get the tickets for Cork at the, if you go to the Cork Science Festival website, you'll see it there, or you go to the British Council website. And for the Galway Science Festival, same thing, go to the Galway Science Festival. And for Dublin, just go to the Smock Alley Theatre website.
Brilliant,
and get tickets there.
Well, tell you what, it sounds absolutely wonderful. Engineer and scientist Dr. Niamh Shaw, thank you so much for talking to us
this
morning. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Now, there's a very special cafe in Galway, which is a hub for encouraging people to develop their faith and relationship with Jesus, and also welcomes non-believers who are curious or want to ask questions, alongside great food and coffee. And I've been there a number of times, and it's a great spot. My favourite cafe in Galway by a long shot. And on the line to tell us more about the cafe called On Tubernua and the services they provide, we have Tommy O'Loughlin, head counsellor at On Tubernua Galway. You're very welcome to the show, Tommy. How are you?
Oh, good. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
So first of all, Tommy, tell us about On Tubernua and its ethos and its mission.
Well, On Tubernua is, it's a Christian organization. We have the Christian coffee shop downstairs. And although we're Christian, we don't push it back anybody's neck. People come in. The cafe provides, a safe space for people. People come in, they chat. There's always a staff member free to talk to people. If you call in at lunchtime, you'll often see staff members sitting down playing board games. With some of the kids that come in. So that's aside from the reasonably priced food and, the cookies that they all love. So the cafe would be the main part. And out of the cafe is where the counseling service came from, because Susan, back in the late 90s, she's one of the founders. And while working in the cafe downstairs, a lot of people would come in and share various issues with her and problems, and she didn't feel that she had the skills to be able to deal with some of the issues she was hearing about. So she decided to train as a counselor, and that was in 2003 that she qualified. So that's when the counseling service was first established. Now, that was only Susan here at that time. She was the only counselor. And a year later, I trained, and in 2005, I qualified. And began seeing clients on a part-time basis. They also worked in the cafe.
So Tommy, what kind of issues are coming in, through the cafe to the counselling service to you?
Yeah, well, a lot of anxiety, depression, Yeah, and as you know, the suicide rates here are quite high.
Sure.
So we're on the canal. People will often just call in for a chat, and a staff member might be downstairs and talking to them, and then they'll say, they'll ring us in the counselling service and they'll say, listen, there's somebody here, and we often just ask them to call in and book an appointment. So we see a lot of anxiety, depression, addiction. So what we see, again, myself, I'm trained, although my degree is in general counselling, I have a master's in child and adolescent counselling. So I'm able to work with teens also. And then Megan, who's the other counsellor here, she's a master's in family and couples therapy. So we see one-to-one adults. I see children and adolescents, and she's able to see families. And we do this all, again, on a donation basis. We do have a suggested donation, but it depends on where that client is coming from. So our counselling could start at €10, which is quite cheap.
It's incredibly cheap, yeah. But amazing value, yeah.
Yeah, because sometimes people come in, it might be a single mother, could be anybody, you know, and they wouldn't be able to afford €65 for counselling. So we're able to provide that service, long and short-term counselling also. You know, I could have a client for 3-4 years. It's not 6 sessions and they're out.
Absolutely.
You know, it's long-term and short-term counselling. And we also have 2 student counsellors working with us at the moment to help us with the load.
Yeah, the load is right. I work in this area myself, as you know, and it's just... You are flat out at the moment. It's just there's such an enormous need for people for therapy and counselling. There's no doubt.
Definitely, and especially this time of year as well. You know, coming up to Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a huge need. Yeah.
So now the main reason for our phone call is because you have an upcoming fundraiser in order to help this amazing work that you do in Antobarnua, and we really support it here on the station. We think you're fabulous. So tell us what it is and what it's about.
Okay, so this year we've decided to run a fundraiser to help us. Like last year, we were able to see, just with Megan and I and 2 part-time student counselors, we were able to see 114 clients. And again, we could be seeing the client for a whole year or 5 years.
Sure.
So to help us to pay, you know, the service costs a lot of money, we're going to run a fundraiser coffee morning on Saturday the 16th of November. We're going to be offering all our own baked goods, our cakes, cookies, everything on the morning. We're going to have raffle prizes. People have generously donated spot prizes for the day. It's going to be a lot of fun and a great, you know, time to hear more about what we do here. So it'll just be really good. And anybody that can come out and support us, it would be amazing. You know, because each time you support, you have a cup of tea or a coffee, you know, you're helping somebody.
Absolutely. So I want to get the details right. It's Saturday the 16th, which is Saturday week. Am I right, yeah?
Saturday week, yeah. The 16th at 10 a.m. until 1 p.m.
So it's the morning, 10 a.m. till 1 p.m. Yeah. And it's a coffee morning. So you're going to take some donations as well while you're at it?
Yeah, we're going to take donations on the morning. We'll have donation jars. All over the room, you know.
Brilliant.
There'll be no set charge for tea or cake or anything like that. People will just donate free to donate whatever you can.
Yeah, and so if you're at all anywhere in the Galway area, and by Galway I mean anywhere on the western seaboard, get yourselves to Antobarnua for the morning of the 16th, Saturday the 16th. So the cafe's open every week from Tuesday to Saturday, and you're
Tuesday,
kind of it's a daytime thing, isn't it? 10:30 to 5, is that right?
Yeah, and that's when we'd see clients also, you know, during the day, so Tuesday to Saturday.
Okay, so how can people find out more information and support this fundraiser?
Well, calling in, and we also have a website, you know, if you just, and a Facebook page on Antobarnua Counselling. So if you just pop in there, have a look. People that also want to donate and they're not in the city, they can phone us and donate over phone also on 091-562-175. If they want to support us and they're not in the area, that would be great also.
And the website is antobarnua.com, am I right?
Yeah, and again, we have a Facebook page, Antobarnua Counselling, also, and you'll find us on Facebook.
Lovely. So Tommy O'Loughlin, Head Counsellor at Antobarnua. Galway, thank you so much for talking to us today, and we wish you
thank you very, very much
best for that, and I really hope that everybody turns out in force on the 16th of November between 10 and 1 and gives you lots of money to keep that great work going, okay? God bless you.
Thanks a million. Okay, bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye now. That's great. And once again, on thobernua.com is the website, and they are at 25 to 27 Lower Dominic Street, Galway, open from Tuesday to Saturday between 10:30 a.m. and 5 p.m. And they're just right on the canal there, as Tommy himself says. So we wish them the very best for that. Really, really excellent outreach, and my goodness, is it needed.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.